Welcome to Drinks Insider, the podcast that's interested in everything you can drink. If it's legal, if you can sell it, and more importantly, if you can make money from it, then we're going to talk about it. So come on this journey into the commercial world of everything drinkable. I'm your host, Felicity Carter, and you're listening to Drinks Insider. Reading about the wine category can sometimes feel a bit depressing lately, with sales slowdowns and tales of consumers abandoning the category. Well, today I'm joined by someone who isn't just optimistic, but who's putting money behind that optimism. John Sutton is CEO of The Wine Group, the US's second largest wine producer. Earlier this year, The Wine Group acquired a whole bunch of wine brands from Constellation in one fell swoop, including Meiomi, Robert Mondavi Private Selection, and Woodbridge, plus three production facilities and some 6,600 acres of vineyards across California. Now, this is more than a vote of confidence in wine. It's the kind of deal making that can reshape the landscape. So I wanted to know, what makes John Sutton so optimistic? As always, if you want more information, sign up for the newly relaunched Drinks Insider newsletter at drinksinsider.com. John, thank you very much for joining me. And to start, I've read that you used to work in the Clinton White House. Could you start off by telling us about that?
Sure. First of all, I'm happy to be here this morning with you. I was really fortunate to work for the Deputy Chief of Staff in the White House during Clinton's first term. And I tell people all the time that I peaked in my 20s. I was fortunate, even though I was a low-level staff person, I sat right in the chief of staff suite. I had the vice president right to my left. The Oval Office was 15 feet down the hall. So I really had a front row seat to everything, just watching how government worked at its highest level. And I really learned a lot during that period of time that served me well on the business front. I learned, you know, really hard work and perseverance will take you farther in life than anything else. You don't necessarily have to be the smartest person in the room, but you better be well prepared and you better outwork everybody else there. And if you do that, you'll go very, very far. Go ahead.
Well, people are quite cynical now about politics. Did the experience leave you feeling cynical, or did it leave you feeling like actually you were in good hands?
A little bit of both, if I were being honest. You know, I think back then, at least, there was a little more compromise. There was a little bit more working together. I think politics has always been polarizing, but probably not to the same extent that, you know, it is today. Everybody was at least closer together, you know, kind of back then compared to today. But, you know, one thing that's always stuck with me in that I learned back then, that somebody pulled me aside one day and gave me some great advice that is actually applicable to politics, particularly today, but I've carried it into the business world as well. And this person said to me, be nice to everybody on the way up because they're going to pass you on the way down. And so I it's really true in politics where people are powerful for one period of time and then power and influence completely changes. But even in the business world, I tell people, you know, younger folks in our company all the time, if you take a 20-year time horizon, particularly in our industry that's so small, you don't want to burn any bridges, be nice to everybody, because you're going to cross paths again at some point, whether it's doing a transaction, you need a favor. I've seen so many people that at one point somebody's working for them, 10 years later, that dynamic reverses. and you're now working for that person. So that's a lesson in politics that I've always carried with me, even to today.
So you've had quite an extraordinary career. You went from the Clinton White House to studying law, and I think you've got both a JD and an MBA. And then you also did a CPA exam. So, okay, so one, you're a professional student, but can you talk a bit about your pathway from, you know, there to being the head of the wine group?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I always knew I wanted to go back to graduate school. And at the end of the first Clinton term, I was trying to decide whether to stay or not. And I thought about it long and hard. And at the time, I was worried that if I stayed the second Clinton term, and then at the time, everybody was thinking Gore would win. And if that happened and I stayed, suddenly I'd be in my young 30s and looking to go back to graduate school. And while that's not impossible, it's just so much harder to do, I think, if you don't do it within maybe the first 5 years or so of college. So I made the decision I was going to make that transition, take a longer term career view, and I couldn't decide between law school or business school. So I ended up doing both, a joint JD MBA program. Then when I graduated, I became an M&A and VC lawyer, and completely coincidental, the very first M&A transaction I got assigned to at a law firm was the wine group buying the Glen Ellen brand from Diageo. And I think the third deal was the wine group buying the Concannon brand from the Wente family. So that's how I got my exposure at the beginning. This is back in 2001 to the wine group and the industry in general. And that's how I got exposed to the industry, started to gain an interest in wine. Then you fast forward to about 2007, I kind of got tired of moving from transaction to transaction and really wanted to stick my teeth into a business. And I was fortunate enough, the wine group hired me at that time as general counsel.
Wow. Were you a wine drinker through all of this, or was this something that you learned on the job?
I was definitely a wine drinker, but my exposure to the industry was really through M&A and kind of general contract work. I really didn't know anything about winemaking, operations, any of kind of the nuts and bolts of the industry, and kind of really learned that and stuck my teeth once I joined the wine group in 2007.
That's interesting. All right. So, and where did the CPA exam come in?
Well, so that's a funny story. So back in probably, I think it was 2010, my boss at the time, who was CFO, pulled me aside one day, sat me down, and he said, "I've got some good news for you and some bad news." I said, "Okay, great. What's the good news?" He said, "The good news is I plan to retire in about 3 years, and I think you would be the best candidate to succeed me." I said, "Oh, that's great news. What's the bad news?" I said, "Well, the bad news is you have to go get your CPA." And so I ended up finding this program down at Santa Clara University in Silicon Valley that it was over a summer period. They actually offered, it was 7 classes over 10 weeks. And you go to school every day for that 10-week period. And at the end of it, you'd have enough credit to go sit down for the study for the CPA exam. So I did that while working full time. The company let me do that, but I had to catch up on work and stay involved at night. So it was a very hectic 3-month period to study for that. But it's all
funny listening to you because you sound very calm. You've got quite a calm voice, but you must work like nothing. You must like work 20 hours a day to get all of this done.
Well, as I said earlier, one thing I believe in is always outworking your competition and always being overly prepared. But I don't work 20 hours a day, but there's probably not a day that I'm not thinking about the business, you know, even on weekends, even in the shower or something like that. You've got to be thinking about the business and the competition.
Okay, so let's get to the hardcore stuff now. So this is a time that the business demands a lot of attention. You know, over the period that you've been involved, it's gone from, you know, the biggest expansion in sort of history to a period of contraction at the moment. So let's talk a bit about that. Let's talk a bit about the wine group. You've described it as having the soul of a startup. What do you mean by that? What does that mean in operational terms?
Yeah, so first of all, we want to be like a startup and strive to be one, but I recognize that our size, that we're not actually a startup. But what we mean by that is we have very little bureaucracy. We don't have a lot of layers within our organization. Every manager is a roll up their sleeves, hardworking, you know, manager that's deeply involved in the business. We empower our teams to make fast decisions and really move quickly. And although it's harder as we've gotten bigger and bigger, we don't have a lot of process in place. And so we truly believe our strategic advantage is being nimble, being able to move fast like a startup, and really to make quick decisions. And if we make a mistake, that's okay. We learn from them and just kind of move on. But we just believe if we can outwork and outmaneuver and be faster than our competition, even at our size, good things will result from that.
Now, am I right about this, but the wine group is the largest private label supplier of wine by volume in the U.S.?
You are. You're correct about that. And that's a business for us that's really strategic on two fronts. Number one, pretty much every retail buyer in the U.S. has a stated goal to grow their private label business. Some more ambitious than others, but all want to grow their private label business. So we really look at that business as strategically important to help retailers grow their business, meet their goals, and partner with them in a way that we both can mutually benefit from. And then second, it's just financially a smart decision to do. You know, private label wine is one of the few areas in the wine category right now in the U.S. that is actually growing. So it's a really important business for us kind of historically and moving forward.
Yeah, I'm always really surprised because, you know, I'm in Europe where private label is absolutely enormous, and yet it's never occupied that place in the United States. Is there a reason for that?
It is starting to gain more importance. I don't think it's going to gain quite the same share that it is in Europe and in the UK. I think here in the US, there's probably a little bit more focus, particularly among suppliers, on just national branded products. But it is growing in share. You know, private label in the U.S. is about a 6% share today, and I can see it getting up to 9 or 10% over time, over the next 5 years. So maybe not quite to the level in Europe, but definitely growing.
Yeah, I mean, it would seem to me to be a good time to be in it because there's so much, you know, supply of good quality wine around at the moment. It would seem like an ideal sort of segment to be in.
It is, absolutely. And I think what you're seeing right now, consistent with national branded trends, you're seeing a premiumization in the private label business as well. Historically, it's been a big share, call it under $6. And we sell a lot of those high volume wines under $6. But I think what you're seeing now, the fastest growing private label category is really in that $8 to $11 range. And a lot of that has to do with, you know, both the consumer demand for it, but what you're talking about, there's so much good excess wine out there that, that so many suppliers are looking to use that wine into higher and higher price points wherever they can.
Yeah, I'll get on to premiumization in a moment because that's endlessly interesting. But the reason I wanted to talk to you is because the wine group made a whole bunch of acquisitions early this year. Mondavi, Meiomi, I think. What's the logic of buying wine brands right now when the market is in something of a slump?
Yeah, so I think for us, there were a lot of attractive aspects of that acquisition with Constellation. Number one, we like playing the role of consolidator in the industry. We like acquiring very high volume, even declining brands. It's a core strength of ours to try to attempt to turn those trends around or at least slow them down. And with our operational efficiencies, we can often get some great synergies out of these brands. In addition, we have a stated goal of trying to get premiumize ourselves and get up to $30 kind of on the retail shelf. So this acquisition gave us brands like Meiomi and Simi that are about at that $16 to $18 range. So we got some great high volume, kind of under $10 brands. We got some higher price brands in Meiomi and Simi. And we also acquired some great internal capabilities in terms of the ability operationally to produce Tetra product and can product and sparkling capabilities as well.
I just want to break this down a bit. So how do you rehabilitate a brand, particularly in this market, and say an under $10 brand, which is the segment of the market that's really not in such great shape? So give me a theoretical brand. It doesn't have to be a real brand. But what steps do you do to try and either move it up in price point or keep the volume?
Yeah, so sometimes it starts with just putting more focus on the brand and attention than maybe the person that we bought it from did. So you make it a focus or a priority. But then often it you know, we'll do some slightly different tactics on the marketing side, in the programming side, really trying to do a deep dive to connect to the consumer that's actually buying that wine in a more meaningful way. And then we'll look to innovate and line extend often with products that we think that consumer that's buying the brand is kind of looking for.
Can you give me an example of this? Because this is the question that everybody is interested in. You know, how do you build a brand in this market, or how do you refurbish a brand? Can you give me some concrete examples of things that you might do?
Sure. So I just ran through a couple of them, but things like changing up the marketing focus a little bit with different kinds of programs or tactics that, you know, maybe a program wasn't working before, but we're trying to, whether it's through couponing, bringing the consumer back in, you know, you might start with couponing and discounting to bring the consumer back and then start to market them more in a traditional manner. We like to innovate and line extend. I think that's a big tactic that we'll often use to bring the consumer back. So in this market, that could be innovation and maybe not a traditional varietal, but it can be a fruit flavored product. It could be in sparkling. It can be in something like a mimosa, if that's the right kind of product
Have you got an example of a brand that you've actually done that to that you could talk about?
Yeah, Beringer Main and Vine is kind of a brand that we acquired from Treasury, you know, several years ago. We haven't turned that into, I would say, positive trends, but we've essentially slowed down the trends on those. Seven Deadly Sins is another brand that we acquired back in 2018 at a higher price point that it's declining today, but for a number of years, we were able to take some negative trends and extend it.
So what was it you saw in those brands that were in decline that you thought, yes, I can make something of that? Like if you were, you know, looking at the marketplace, what are the key things that you say, yes, I can do something with that versus not touching that one?
It's usually if it still has a high consumer, but maybe velocity is slowed down. And so we're then looking at ways at, you know, sort of reinvigorating the brand to recapture that consumer and increase velocity. So it's got to have good distribution. It's got to have a strong consumer base. And then often if there's a heritage to the brand or some kind of history there that we can kind of lean back. So to give you an example, in the current acquisition we did, we can look at both Robert Mondavi Private Selection at about the $10 price point that has the whole history of the Mondavi consumer kind of behind it. And then you take Meiomi that's still about 1.8 million cases today. So there's obviously a huge consumer following that's still there. And so we think often with certain tactics, changing the packaging, changing the marketing, putting more time, attention, focus, and innovation, we can tap into that existing consumer, often bring it back to its roots to when it started, what was successful then, and kind of try to reinvigorate the brand.
That's so interesting. So if I understand what you're saying correctly, sometimes brands are dying just because they've been neglected rather than there's something intrinsically wrong with them.
That's correct. Either neglected or they just veer, for whatever reason, the core marketing just veered away from what was successful, you know, originally. And I won't suggest that, you know, we're going to be successful on reinvigorating every single brand or every time, you know, we sort of try, but we still believe there's a consumer for a lot of these brands. They just have so much choice. And if you turn the attention away for even a minute, they're gone, you know, but there's always the opportunity to try to win them back.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Okay, so you've got a massive portfolio. I think you've got more than 60 brands. So how do you make sure that everything has its own identity and they don't cannibalize each other? How do you segment them?
So we do a lot of portfolio segmentation, and we're constantly reevaluating our portfolio, really with the eye toward what the consumer trends are and how consumer preferences are changing. But we'll segment really one of two ways. We'll segment by price point. So as I mentioned earlier, we really strive to have a diversified portfolio really up to $30 in retail. And so we'll segment that portfolio by price point, really trying to have, if possible, a power brand or a leading brand at every price point, and then supplement that with innovation kind of behind it to try to grow. And then second, we'll segment, I think, like a lot of people do, maybe not in using exactly this terminology, but segment with growth brands, kind of harvest brands, manage brands, and maybe surgical, where we're going to sell brands in just certain channels like on-premise, or convenience. Because the reality, even though we have probably close to 100 brands, you know, we do.
Oh, okay. So I'm off by nearly 50%.
Yeah. If you count private label, we do have a lot. But we do have to prioritize and focus, because ultimately we can't ask our salespeople to sell everything and our wholesalers to execute on everything. So we do try to segment that portfolio into, you know, growth opportunities, manage opportunities, and then you can call it a big bucket of all others that we know won't get a lot.
What's the moment where you go, it's time to say goodbye to this one, like Concannon or another one? What's the moment that you go, nah, this one? Is it because it competes for something in the portfolio? Is it slows down? Is it that you just think you don't have the capacity to grow it any further? What's the decision process?
It's a couple of those things. It's largely a slowdown where we think we just can't grow it anymore. And it's just getting sort of beat by competition. And we know our core strength is really dealing with large, high volume, nationally focused brands. And so when something kind of loses that momentum and loses that volume, like a Concannon, then we know it's probably time to move off of that. And when that happens, you know, when we have a brand like Concannon that has such a rich history in the industry, we take that responsibility really seriously. And so we'll try to find a buyer that we think will put the time, attention, and focus on a brand like Concannon more than we will. And so we were really fortunate to find a local buyer, the Lemons family, for the Concannon brand, that we think will give it the time and attention it deserves. Years ago, we sold the Inglenook brand to Francis Ford Coppola, who bought the high-end Inglenook facility up in St. Helena. So we take our responsibility seriously when we have brands that really have a rich history. And if we're not going to put the time, attention, and focus on them, we try to get them in the hands of somebody who will.
And when do you decide that you should build a brand rather than acquire it?
So our acquisition strategy, it's really has two prongs to it. One, as I mentioned earlier, we do like kind of high volume declining brands and taking on that challenge of trying to turn them around. We like playing the role of consolidator. I think a lot of people shy away either from negative trends or adding multiple SKUs and the complexity that adds. So we're always looking for those type of brands and acquisitions. But second, we're always also looking for brands that if it has something that we just can't do ourselves internally. So for example, it has a sense of place or authenticity that you just can't create. You know, that can come from a vineyard or a tasting room or some story that you just can't do internally. Then we'll look for that kind of acquisition to fill a gap. Otherwise, if we can do it ourselves, we're probably going to innovate internally and do it ourselves.
Yeah, let's talk a bit about premiumization. So everyone's still hoping that premiumization will hold up. But what's happening at the value end? This is the end that's under extreme pressure internationally, with huge numbers of vineyards being ripped up. So why in a inflationary environment or a more economically difficult environment does this segment no longer hold as much appeal as it once did?
Yeah, so, I think what's really going on under $10, there's three challenges. Number one, and really the best explanation I think I've heard for a from it, is really what's happening under 10 is it reflects the income divide that's kind of going on in America right now. And I think those consumers that are doing well in this economy are still buying $15 plus wines. And those that are struggling have either traded way down toward the bottom, like to our Francia brand, or they've traded out of the category. And that has been really the biggest surprise to me over the last, call it, 3 or 4 years, because historically what's happened when there's been tough times, either a recession or challenging economic environment, the consumer has traded down to $8 to $10 wine. And you're not seeing that now. The worst performing price point in the category between $6 and $10, and it's getting worse. And I think it's largely a reflection of the income divide in America.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was talking to a bank analyst this morning about premiumization, and he said maybe it's just that people have traded up, and once you've traded up, you can't stand the taste of products further down. You'd rather change the category entirely. What do you think about that?
You know, I don't think that's necessarily true, because there's so many great wines, you know, I think at that, you know, $10 and below price point. I just think, you know, I mentioned the premium, the income divide effect, but I think also when you look under $10 now, that's different. That consumer has so much more choice than it used to have. And, you know, you're talking about the RTDs, spirit, cannabis, functional beverages. You could even throw in the $7 a day Starbucks habit that, you know, with coffee that so many people have. And I think wine is a little bit, when you have that competition, it's a little bit challenged from a pricing standpoint, where the cost per ounce of wine, even at the low end, is much higher than those other products. It's a pretty big commitment to ask somebody to buy an $8 bottle of wine that has four glasses to it. The consumer doesn't know what that product is necessarily in the bottle. They don't understand it. And then they're seeing these other categories, these other products where they can get single serve at $2.99, and I think that choice has just put tons of pressure on wines under $10.
So one of the things that is a hot topic at the moment is this question of whether younger consumers are abandoning wine or not, whether they're different from former consumers or whether they're just stuck at a life stage, and when they have more money, they'll start spending. What's your view on this?
Well, I do think... I think that it's a little bit overstated. I do think the young consumer is drinking wine. I think what's different now is, you know, other generations were typically, you were either a wine drinker, a beer drinker, or a spirits drinker. The younger generation crosses the various categories. You know, they drink wine, they drink beer, they drink spirits. And as I mentioned, then you have competition from functional beverages and cannabis. And so I do think the younger generation are wine drinkers, but your wine is kind of fighting for that, call it, share of stomach, and needs to kind of find its place within the younger consumer, their purchasing habits, where they're also purchasing these other categories. I'd also say the younger generation is much more or less traditional about what they consider wine. And they're telling us that they're not purists about what wine is and what wine isn't. So they like a lot of fruit-flavored wines, you know, sparkling wines, alternative packaging.
Yeah, aromatized wines I know are doing really well, and things like Beatbox and so on. So what are you doing in that space?
Yeah, so we actually launched 8 new brands this year. All 8, yeah. A huge number, all really targeted at either specific channels or specific areas where we see there's actual growth. So we launched this year Tetra Pak, a Franzia product called Fuel that is similar to Beatbox with fruit flavored wine. We launched a product under our MD 2020, Mad Dog 2020 brand, similar to Buzz Balls, kind of in that space. And we've launched some line extensions with mimosas and fruit-flavored wine products, margaritas in a box, really all trying to go after this younger generation that I think there's an opportunity for wine with this generation. But wine right now is just thought of from an occasion standpoint of having a glass of wine with dinner. And the industry really needs to expand its definition of occasions, and I think expand what wine is and what isn't, and expand the type of packaging it's in to sort of meet this younger consumer where they are and provide products that meet these other occasions they're looking for.
So everybody's interested in this segment. So let me ask you, have you tried anything that hasn't worked? Have you had any disasters where you thought this was going to be fantastic and it just didn't work? And if so, why?
Probably the biggest thing that I thought was going to work and hasn't worked has been wine and candy. And I'm actually a believer. I'm one of the few probably that are out there that's actually a believer long term in wine and cans. I think the it's perfect for the occasions that consumers are looking for, and the industry will figure it out. But I think what happened was there's still some challenges to figure out with how wine interacts with the aluminum and cans. So you had some taste challenges, and then you kind of had a race to the bottom with pricing. So the quality of wine and cans wasn't great. But I think long term, as that technology gets figured out and wine interacts better with cans, I think people will premiumize. You'll see better wine quality in the cans. And I'm still a believer in that vessel and vehicle long term. I just thought it would be more successful.
Yeah, I'm actually really surprised that you said that. I thought you were going to say, no, cans are flying off the shelf. okay, so and what has worked so well that surprised you? Did anything come out of the gate that you went, ooh, wasn't expecting that?
You know, it's probably just the RTD success, and how much that category has both exploded and taken share away from, traditional wine and traditional spirits, I just think has been, and how quickly it's happened, I think has just really been surprising. You know, maybe not the success of the products, but how big it's become, and it's not going anywhere either. So that's probably been the biggest surprise.
The wine group is very strong in the Better For You category. Can you explain what the Better For You category is and its evolution and where it is at the moment?
Sure. Better For You category in wine is typically refers to either low-alc or non-alc wines. And this is a category right now in the wine space that's growing, albeit off a low base. And I think everybody's kind of wondering where it's going to go, particularly on the non-alc side. I don't think it's going to go away. I don't think there's any question that it's going to be around. I think the real question is how big is it going to get? Right now it's growing, but off a low base. And many retailers are really grappling with how to deal with it. You know, some are dedicating sets in stores just to know out. And others, it's just kind of put on the shelf mixed with regular wine. And so I think everybody's just waiting for the shakeout to see kind of how big this is going to get over time.
Okay, so talk about packaging innovation. Do you think that boxed wine is going to play a bigger role in the U.S. wine market in future?
I definitely do. I mean, first off, our Francia brand has been the number one selling wine in the world for over 20 years. And that comes in a 5-liter box. So obviously we know that package, at least in the 5-liter size, has always worked and been there. Then you kind of look at what's growing in the category today, and you know, what's really working is competitive brands like Black Box and Bota Box in the 3-liter size. So there's obviously a consumer there. What hasn't happened so far is at least on the retail side, nobody's been successful at kind of crossing that $20 price point. But I think that's coming. You see out there in the market right now, there's some really nice packaging of some real regional, not widely distributed brands yet that are kind of at that $30 to $40 price point. A couple that are working really well, DTC. So I think it's just a matter of time before the 3-liter box category in particular starts to take off above $20.
Yeah. Now, I think I read somewhere that the wine group might be expanding into spirits and functional beverages. Is that true? And if so, how aggressively are you pursuing that?
Well, it is true. Expanding into spirits and functional beverages are part of our kind of 5-year strategic plan. And we have made a couple of minority investments in companies in these spaces. However, I'd say kind of in the short term and maybe even in the medium term, we made the decision about a year ago or so that we were really going to kind of double down and put intense focus on the wine category in our wine business. And that really just came from is even though the category is struggling right now, when you really look and peel back the onion, there are areas of growth and opportunity. You know, the convenience channel is growing. On-premise and club are growing. We've talked about sort of non-traditional wine products and alternative packaging. And so we even look at our own business where we're so heavily concentrated in big retail and see the opportunity where we don't do business with a lot of independent retailers throughout the United States. And so we made the decision that we, in the short run at least, are going to really focus on wine and really hit the channels and the types of products in the wine space that are working today. And then once we've kind of done that and exhausted that route, then I think we'll start to move into spirits and functional beverages.
That's interesting. Okay, so you're obviously still seeing a lot of opportunity in the market. A lot of people are actually a bit depressed at the moment. So if you're going to talk to those people who are all your competitors, where would you say the opportunity was? What gives you hope? You know, what makes you feel optimistic about the wine market in the US?
Well, you've got to sort of peel back the onion. The industry and the category is declining in total, but when you peel back the onion and look at what's actually working, there are opportunities. You know, $15 plus wine that's growing kind of in retail. Things like the non-wine or non-traditional wine products, things like Beatbox, you know, Big Sips, those are working. Wine and alternative packaging, single serve, Tetras, even 375s are working. And so I think if you wine and convenience is working. So I think if you have a channel by channel strategy and you expand your mind a little bit beyond sort of what traditional wine looks like, you'll see this opportunity for what's growing and what's not growing. And I'd mention one other thing really fast, which sort of ties into the question earlier on the non-alc and low-alc wine. There's also an interesting trend going on that's not getting a lot of, I think, written about it on the opposite end, which is very high alcohol product.
Yes, I'm so glad you brought that up. Yes, I've been hearing about it a little bit, but can you tell me more about that?
Yeah, Vince, so on the opposite spectrum, very high alcohol wines are growing as well. And somebody sent me an interesting slide last week that broke down wine by alcohol level. And it was showing, you know, non-alc was growing something like 28% off of, albeit a small base, but growing. And then wines above 14.5% alcohol were growing. And everything between those two was declining.
That is so interesting. Do you know who it is that's buying these big wines? Who's the consumer for this?
You know, we're still trying to figure that out, but, you know, we have a theory that it might be the same consumer, you know, and particularly the younger consumer, where maybe either on a weekday or if they're at an event and they've had a spirit drink or a wine drink, one or two, and then want to switch, they'll go to low alc or non-alc. But on other occasions, albeit maybe it's a sporting event, a birthday party, whatever it is, they're actually starting their occasion with a much higher alcohol product. And so
that is so interesting. I've seen some artwork for some Australian wines, which are very high in alcohol, that are really sort of leaning into the unhealthy alcohol space. But it's
yeah. I just bring that up because I do find it fascinating that, you know, there's a consumer right now on both sides of that that alcohol space.
That's so counterintuitive. It's kind of funny, but it's really interesting. Okay, so we've talked about where the opportunities are. We've talked about some trends. If you have to predict where the wine group is going to be in 5 years, given how fast the market is changing, what will it look like? How will things be different?
Well, I think the wine group will remain a global leader with a expanded portfolio beyond wine. You know, hopefully, as I mentioned, into the spirits and functional beverage areas, but if nothing else, with non-traditional wine products like RTDs or fruit flavored and sparkling products. Our $15 plus portfolio will hopefully be larger. As I mentioned, our strategy is trying to get up to $30 in retailer. Hopefully we'll have a larger variety of alternative packaging, you know, in terms of boxed wine, cans, Tetras, even 187s, things like that. And I hope we'll have some success in reinvigorating the wine category under $10.
We all hope you do that. We're all behind you. I should ask the question, How do you take a wine and get the price higher? What do you do to convince people to pay more for it?
It is probably one of the biggest challenges that's out there, at least in the wine space, particularly compared to other products, because the consumer has so much choice in wine, they really don't have to follow you up the price ladder. So you really have to do the best you can to try to communicate the value that's there in the wine, the value that they're still getting even at the higher price point. But it's a real challenge in a category that doesn't have a lot of loyalty and among brands and has a huge amount of choice. It's why so much of the industry is always so hesitant to try to take price.
Yeah. All right. Look, I think we've been through just about everything. It's been fantastic to talk to you. And it's fantastic to talk to somebody who's optimistic at the moment about things. So, John Sutton, thank you very much.
Thank you. I really appreciate you having me.
You've been listening to Drinks Insider, the podcast that explores the intersection of beverages and commerce. Now, if you would like a summary of this episode, sign up for the Drinks Insider newsletter, which sends you the takeaways. Just go to drinksinsider.com and add your name. And if there's something you think we should be talking about, drop me a line at felicity@drinksinsider.com. And before you go, please don't forget to rate this podcast. 5 stars are most welcome.